She shook her head, clearly not happy she hadn't scared him off. "I'll take her to the porch. You can stand on the steps to get up. I'm not lifting you."
"Fine with me," Austin agreed evenly.
She walked ahead of him as he carefully moved across the wet ground. He didn't want to risk the crutch slipping and sending him to the ground. Once he made it to the porch, he used the crutches to climb the steps, only a little worried he'd tumble backwards. He'd made progress over the last few days.
"Okay, stand on your good leg, and I'll try and help you get the broken leg up and over," she instructed him.
He nodded, looking at the horse, and realizing just how stupid and dangerous it was to attempt this with a leg that hadn't had the chance to heal. And they weren't even talking about how he'd get on and off without Amanda there to help him. He almost changed his mind, but an image of Savannah, scared and alone, popped into his mind, giving him the courage he needed to try.
"Here goes nothing," he breathed, lifting his bum leg up.
Amanda held it up while he hugged the horse's neck and tried to mount the patient mare. But almost immediately he realized it wouldn't work. The pain in his leg was severe and getting worse. He felt the cut on his side tear, and there was no way he could even get onto the horse without seriously injuring himself all over again, let alone ride 40 miles.
"Give up?" she asked in a soft voice when he stopped actively trying to climb on.
He grunted, willing himself not to fall apart.
"Yes."
She carefully moved his leg away from the horse's back, and then slapped the horse on the butt and sent it running back out to the pasture.
"I'm sorry," she whispered. "I really am. I want to help you, but you are not well. Please, will you give it a couple more days?"
He nodded through gritted teeth.
"Yes."
"Do you want some pain meds?" she asked.
"Yes," he breathed out,
unable to move from his spot where he leaned on his crutch.
"Give yourself a minute, and then we'll go inside," she said, no judgment in her voice.
He felt the heavy weight of defeat weighing him down. At least he'd tried, he told himself. He just wasn't ready to make the journey. Savannah was going to have to hold on a little longer. He closed his eyes, silently willing her all the strength he could muster.
"Hang tight, baby girl. I'm coming," he whispered.
11. Ben punched in the 4-digit code before pushing the heavy steel door open. He dreaded giving the report, knowing he was going to be in trouble. Failure wasn't something that was tolerated. He steeled himself to be berated, and possibly even killed, for failing to complete his mission. There was no point in running, as he knew that would only make it worse. He never knew what to expect with the people he was working with. It was a risk he had willingly taken when he'd signed on. There were always going to be those people in the world who rose above, and that's what he'd wanted for himself. He had situated himself within a group that was one day going to rule the world. He wanted a front row seat, and was willing to do whatever it took to secure it. He'd already done unspeakable things to insert himself into the group. It couldn't be all for naught. He followed the dimly lit hall to its end, his booted feet scraping along the metal floor as he moved. He peered through the small glass window in the door. All 5 of the top commanders were sitting at a table, a series of maps spread out in front of them. They looked to be in a heated discussion. When he'd returned from his failed mission, he'd been informed that they wanted to see him. Taking a deep breath, Ben knocked once, and then opened the door. All eyes were on him, making the news he had to deliver that much harder to say. The men at the table were ruthless, some of the scariest individuals he had ever encountered in his life, and he'd done time in a maximum security prison. The murderers and rapists he'd met there had nothing on the men currently staring him down.
"What did you find?"
the man sitting at the head of the table asked in a gruff voice. His gray beard and beady eyes gave him the appearance of a wizard.
"I couldn't find the drive," Ben admitted,
meeting the steely brown eyes.
"You searched the body?"
"Thoroughly. Searched his pockets, stripped him down and all.
He didn't have it."
"What about the other guy? Who's he?"
Ben cleared his throat, uncomfortable.
"We know he's a journalist, Austin Merriman. He used to be one of those hotshot reporters writing whistleblower stories. Callum's phone records showed he called the guy several times. I hacked his phone and read the messages between them. He never revealed what he had, only that he wanted to meet."
"And who is this Merriman guy now if he's no longer a hotshot reporter?"
"He's a single father traveling with his teenage daughter. His wife died a year ago. He's been writing stories about people living alternative lifestyles. It's a lot of fluff."
"I don't think he's a threat," Ben insisted, hoping to allay the fears of the bosses.
"You don't think? That's an understatement. Why this guy?"
"As far as I can tell, they knew each other in college. Back then, the journalist was a bit of a crusader. I'm guessing that's why Callum reached out to him. Merriman took on tough political stories and exposed cover-ups involving politicians. Callum probably didn't know the guide changed."
There were grunts and groans, followed by more disgusted looks directed his way.
"Did Callum tell him anything? Did Merriman know why they were meeting?"
"Callum didn't tell anything in the messages, only that it was important they meet in person," he reiterated, wanting them to believe his mistake wasn't all that bad.
"I didn't find any records of phone calls between them that lasted more than a few seconds."
"Callum didn't get the chance to tell him what the meeting was about," he said, hoping he sounded confident.
"Does this Merriman have it? The USB that punk stole from us. Did Callum pass it off?" the bearded commander asked in a gruff voice.
Ben nodded slowly. "I believe that's a possibility. They couldn't have been together long before I showed up."
"I shot them both," he said, not admitting that he couldn't say for sure if he'd shot the reporter. But with a spray of bullets, he felt there was no way the guy could have been spared.
"Where is he?" came the irritated question from another man sitting to the leader's left.
"I don't know," he replied.
"How the hell don't you know?"
"He went over the side. I doubt he could have survived. The water was moving fast," he said.
"Never doubt a man's desire to survive, especially a man with a kid. He's out there somewhere. If that drive gets into the wrong hands, we've got problems. It needs to be recovered," his boss declared, sneering at him with disgust.
"I'll go back," he said. "I can start looking for the body immediately, or find him if he's not dead. But I think he is."
"Go back? Where? The bridge? Do you think he's going to be hiding out underneath it? It's been a week," the boss snarled.
"Merriman was staying nearby. One of the messages mentioned a farm. Callum told him where to meet, and Merriman said it would take him about 15 minutes to get there. I'll go there first."
"You didn't check there already?" the voice boomed.
"I did, sir, I did. No one was at the camper. I took care of the farmer who was asking questions. Made it look like a robbery gone bad. He won't be warning Merriman I'm looking for him."
The men at the table exchanged looks with one another.
"This is a colossal screw-up. We have to get the drive back. We need to find that journalist."
"I'll find him. I'll leave now," Ben said, hoping they'd let him walk out of there.
They blamed him for failing to complete the mission,
and it was true that Callum Barker had been his responsibility. But the guy had been smart and had managed to lose his tail for 30 minutes. By the time he'd caught up to him, it had been too late. He had eliminated Callum, but the information that could disrupt their entire plan was out there somewhere. He only hoped it had drowned with the reporter, and that he could somehow find the jerk's body. "No, you've done enough. We need someone more reliable on this," the leader of their faction declared, slapping a hand on the stainless steel table.
"Who?"
"Get me Craven," the leader growled.
"Xander?"
he asked, irritated his colleague was going to get the job that should have been his.
"Yes, Alexander Craven. He'll get this handled. We can't have that intel getting out. I will not allow one man to ruin everything we've worked so hard to achieve. Phase one is complete. To stay on track, we have to get that intelligence back. If it falls into the wrong hands..."
He let the sentence hang unfinished, leaving everyone to draw their own conclusions. They all knew what would happen. They'd all go to prison for a long time, or possibly be executed for treason. Ben turned to leave. There was no point in arguing. He knew they could decide to put a bullet between his eyes for the enormous screw-up he'd made. He'd just have to find a way to get back in their good graces. After all, he'd been a part of it from the beginning. He wanted to see it through to the end. He'd worked too hard and sacrificed too much to let someone else kick him out of the organization now. Xander or anyone else. 12. Malachi watched Savannah through the trees. She was collecting firewood for the campfire. They had been walking for several days now, and he thought she'd have cheered up by now. But the fact that it was so slow going wasn't aiding anyone's outlook. They hadn't encountered anything too serious, but the information they had been picking up along the way was alarming. They'd already been warned against going anywhere near Lexington. Apparently, the city had erupted into violence a couple days after the blackout. People were fleeing en masse. The stories were bad enough that the Loveridges and their companions had decided to take a wide berth around the city, adding what would probably amount to an extra day of travel.
"Malachi?"
His father's voice had startled him, making him jump.
"What?"
he asked, spinning around, feeling both guilty and afraid that his dad would see what he'd been doing. His father looked over his shoulder, sighed, and then looked back at Malachi, slowly shaking his head.
"You're tempted."
"I'm sorry. Son, it's okay. It's natural. Please just be careful. I'm here if you have any questions," he said.
"I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure she's okay. I told her she shouldn't go into the woods alone," Malachi stammered.
His father smiled, patting Malachi on the shoulder. "I'll help her. Go back and help your mom make the beds for the night." He nodded and headed back towards the area where they were setting up camp. His mother was on her knees, piling leaves and pine needles into small rows for them each to sleep on. The bedding wasn't as nice as a mattress, but it provided a small barrier between them and the hard earth that would be damp after a spring rainstorm earlier in the day.
"Hey there,"
she said, looking up at him. Looking at her face, he noticed the paleness. They had little to eat, as living off the land wasn't easy. They could grow food, but not while traveling, and they knew little about wild edibles. Gretchen, from somewhere back east, had been identifying things like dandelions and some other weeds for them to eat, but it wasn't enough. They'd long since gone through the little food they'd taken from their camp a week ago, as well as what little had been left at the little farm.
"Mom, I'll do that. Rest," he said, moving to scoop up some leaves.
"It's fine. I can do this. You can finish building that fire ring," she said, her voice weak.
Without bothering to argue, he moved to do her bidding. He kept glancing back, though, watching her move slowly. She was growing more lethargic. They all were. He kept his focus on the fire, then, until his dad came back into camp with Savannah, each of them carrying a pile of branches in their arms.
"Dad, we have to try hunting. We're starving," Malachi said.
"Son, we have no skills for hunting. None of us knows how. We don't have tools to hunt with," he replied.
"We have that revolver. Ken knows how to use it," he reminded him.
Ken stepped forward, carrying more firewood.
"We've only got a handful of bullets, and we'd go through them fast trying to hunt. It's been years since I've done any hunting, so I don't know that I could vouch for my shots being true. We've got so many mouths and so few bullets. I don't know that it'd be worth it."
"Maybe we could set traps," Savannah suggested.
Jim turned to look at her.
"Traps? I used to watch a show, like Men Surviving in the Woods. They would use different types of traps to catch things, like squirrels and birds and whatever they could get. They used wire or rope, making little nooses on trees or along the ground. Sometimes they'd use a stick to hold up a heavy rock, and when the animal went under it, the rock would fall and kill it."
Malachi heard his mother gasp in shock behind him, but the idea didn't bother him, not like it might have some weeks before. He was hungry. The idea of killing didn't appeal to him, but they had to eat. Malachi eyed Savannah, thinking about the suggestions.
"Squirrels? I was thinking of something like a deer."
She put her hand on a hip and glared at him.
"Have you seen a deer?"
He shrugged.
"No." "Have you seen a squirrel?"
"Okay. Yeah, a lot of them," he acknowledged, frowning.
"Exactly."
He could hear his mother snickering behind them, clearly over her initial horror at the thought of killing little woodland creatures.
"Okay, I get it. It isn't that simple. Why don't we try to go into that town we saw the sign for? We could pay for food," he suggested.
"Son, nobody wants our money," his dad said gently.
"Maybe that was only those two towns. The city we're close to looked bigger on the map. They're probably still taking cash. We have to try. We have to eat," he pleaded, hunger making him cranky.
He looked to his parents, begging them to hear his words.
"Jim, he's right. We have to try. Maybe we can ask politely for handouts if they won't take our money," his mother said.
Malachi looked hopefully at his father.
"Dad?"
It took another second, but the man agreed.
"Fine, we'll try, but it could be dangerous. People are going to be turning on those who believe in God. You heard what that last group told us. The city is in chaos."
"We won't go into the city," Malachi insisted. "We'll stick to the suburbs." "Why would anyone turn on those who believe in God?" Savannah asked, as if it was the silliest thing she'd ever heard.
Jim, always the patient man, turned to her and smiled.
"Because, dear, it is in times like these that the unfaithful believe God has abandoned them. They will hate those who still believe. They will mock us and want to try and punish us. It is all written in the Bible."
She scoffed. "The Bible predicted there was going to be a blackout? I find that hard to believe."
Malachi froze in place, shocked by her blatant refusal to believe his father. His father, of all people. He was used to people coming to the tent meetings and being a little skeptical, but Savannah had seen what was happening. She had to realize things were terrible. It wasn't going to get better for a long time, if ever.
Just then, they heard the crunching of leaves and twigs, and all spun to look in the direction of the sound. It was Gretchen and the others coming back with their gatherings of what could only be called weeds. Gretchen stopped, her boyfriend Tim beside her. They looked guilty.
"Jim, Tanya, I'd like to introduce you to Bonnie and Bill," Gretchen said, stepping to the side.
Malachi stiffened when he saw a large man and woman coming through the trees. The man was probably 50, balding and huge. He guessed he was over 6 feet tall and had to weigh close to 300 pounds. The woman was a little shorter, but she was just as big. His first thought was that they had been eating well for a while. Jim stepped in front of the family. "Hello, Bonnie, Bill," he said, extending his hand to each of them in turn. Malachi wasn't quite as welcoming. They had encountered a young couple a few days before, and they hadn't been nearly as polite as the Loveridges felt the need to be. They had looked nice enough, but when his father had attempted to talk to them, they had cursed at them and told them to get away, brandishing a semi-automatic handgun to get their message across. He was a little wary of strangers now, despite his father's opinion that all people were good until proven otherwise. Even then, his father encouraged Malachi to see the good in all people. Gretchen was smiling.
"Bill has some beef jerky he's offered to share with us, as well as some rice. They'd like to travel with us," she added more hesitantly.
"Oh, really?" Jim asked, clearly pleased with the new additions. His mother stepped forward.
"Hi, I'm Tanya Loveridge, and it's good to meet you both. This is our son, Malachi, and Savannah is traveling with us. There are others in our group who will return soon. We are still setting up camp."
Everyone shook hands and went through the general niceties. "We'd love to have you join us," Malachi heard his father say, and cringed.
"Dad, can I talk to you for a minute?" Malachi said in a low voice.
His father nodded. "Sure."
"Over here,"
Malachi said, separating them from the rest of the group.
"What is it, Mal?"
"Dad, is it wise to bring new people into our group? We don't know them. They could be dangerous," he whispered.
"Malachi, we don't judge. We meet people we don't know all the time. We didn't know Gretchen or Tim or any of the other people we're traveling with until we did. Does that make sense?" he asked.
Malachi struggled.
"It does, but, Dad, things are different. What if they're dangerous?"
Jim Loveridge put a hand on his son's shoulder as if to ground him.
"I think we have to trust God's plan. Let's look at the positive side of this. They brought food. You were just saying we needed food, and God delivered."
Malachi sighed. He knew there was no arguing with his father in matters like this. His father was a faithful believer and would never turn away anyone in need. He believed in redemption for all and loved to be the one to lead them to it. If these people wanted to join them, he'd be the first to welcome them, again and again.
"Okay, but please, we have to be careful," Malachi insisted.
"Of course, son, of course," his father said, patting him on the shoulder as they returned to the group.
Bonnie was kneeling on the ground, unloading her backpack. Malachi's eyes fell on the jerky then, and his stomach immediately started to rumble. It wasn't a meal, but it was much better than the pile of dandelions he saw stacked on a piece of cardboard. He got busy building the fire ring. The sun was already setting, and he knew the chill that night would be fierce. Savannah took over making the beds while his mother and Bonnie chatted. He got the fire going, thankful they had a lighter. He had no idea what they would do if it ran out of fuel, but that was a worry for later.
He wished someone from one of those shows Savannah talked about would walk into their camp. That's what they really needed. They needed someone who could hunt, fish, gather supplies, and protect them. With water boiled for drinking, and the rest of the group returned, they all sat around the fire while his mother distributed their meager food offerings. His father said a blessing, thanking God for the food and the new arrivals. Instead of closing his eyes, Malachi stole looks, checking out Bonnie and Bill. They had their eyes closed and their hands folded together as his father spoke to God. "So, tell us where you're from," Tanya suggested, once they had all finished their tiny dinners. Bonnie looked to her husband.
"We left Nashville a couple weeks ago. We figured we would head north."
"North?" Jim asked. Bill took over the story.
"We were in Nashville when things went dark. We thought it was a blackout, something temporary. Within a few days, we had to run. Things were terrible. Our neighborhood was overrun. We heard all kinds of rumors."
"What kind of rumors?" Malachi asked. Bill and Bonnie exchanged a look.
"There's chaos in Washington, or what's left of it. The president was killed in the attack. The vice president is supposedly hiding out in a bunker, and some of the other top-ranking government officials are in bunkers around the country. Supposedly, there's a safe haven in Seattle. They have food, water, and shelter. We also heard Denver might be a good place to go."
"Denver and Seattle?" Tanya asked excitedly. "Aren't we headed in that direction?"
Bill nodded. "It's a rumor, but it would make sense that the government would set up some kind of shelter."
"Who's in charge?" Jim asked.
Bill shrugged. "No one knows."
"Isn't there a military? Are we under attack?" Tanya asked.
"I don't think anyone knows. It does sound like this is a widespread problem. It isn't isolated to any one city. We thought it was just Nashville. Then we ran into some people from New Orleans, and they said they were headed to Mexico. We considered going that way as well, but we've settled on Seattle. We visited once, and it may be cold, but there's plenty of fishing opportunities and a lot of forest area for hunting. If there's a shelter there, all the better."
"That's where you're headed?" Malachi asked.
Bill nodded. "They have power and are taking in refugees, from what we've heard, but only as many as they can support. We hope to get there before they close the city to newcomers.
It sounds like you're going in that direction, so perhaps we could travel together for a while.
That's what we were thinking, anyway."
Jim Loveridge nodded, even as Savannah chimed in, "That's a long way to go on foot."
"It is. But what choice do we have? We might see what Denver looks like. But I like the idea of having plentiful fishing grounds, as the Pacific would offer in Seattle."
Malachi sat back, blocking out the debate over locations that had come up. The news of the country's turmoil was difficult to accept. Malachi had secretly been hoping they would get to Salt Lake City and discover everything was okay. He hoped the rumors were wrong. Gossip was a tool of the devil. It could all be lies. There was a small chance they could get to the city and find everything was okay. His father would tell him to have faith if he asked. His eyes moved around the circle of people until he saw Savannah. She looked so pretty in the glow of the firelight. But his father was right. He couldn't let himself be tempted by her beauty. She didn't want to go to Salt Lake City with his family, and he knew she wasn't a real believer. Right then, he made a decision to never be alone with her. He'd too often found himself thinking about kissing her, and knew that was wrong. He needed to keep his distance. She was not right for him, not when they'd been traveling this long.
and she still hadn't shown any signs of becoming more interested in their faith. He simply needed to remain pure until he could find the right girl, one who believed as he did and would not question his faith.
13. Savannah had never felt so alone in her life. They'd been walking all day, and no one would really talk to her. Malachi was keeping his distance, though she didn't know what she'd done to make him mad at her. Ever since the new people had shown up, he'd simply quit talking to her. He'd been going out of his way to avoid her, in fact. Tanya and Jim walked together, always talking amongst themselves, and the rest of the group had all divided into pairs, leaving her completely alone. And Malachi was the only one remotely near her age. She didn't understand how he could stand to be so solitary either, or how he could be so hurtful after wanting so badly for her to come along. Part of her wondered if Malachi was mad at her because she'd been unsuccessful in getting food on the trip into town the day before. It had been decided that her, Tanya, Gretchen, and Jim would go into town. They looked the least threatening, and Jim could be very persuasive. Savannah had tried, too. She'd begged and pleaded with several people in a way that had made her feel pathetic, and still nobody had helped. All of them had tried. Jim had managed to get some bread from a kind old woman, but that was it. It didn't seem like Malachi could fault her for what even his mother had failed at accomplishing, but she couldn't imagine what else was going on. When they finally stopped for the night, she decided she was going to get Malachi alone so they could talk. She needed to find out what she had done. She couldn't stand the thought of him hating her, or even another day of solitary travel like this had been. She needed him.
"Malachi, can you help me collect wood?" she asked politely.
"I can't. I have to help my dad," he mumbled, not looking at her. She looked around the group and noticed Jim and Bill talking about 20 feet away from the rest of them. They were huddled together, talking in harsh, quiet voices. Whatever they were talking about had Jim very upset. Obviously, Malachi only wanted to avoid her. Too hurt to question him further, she moved away from him, pretending to be looking for brush and twigs they could burn for fire. She paused near the men, straining her ears to hear what they were talking about. "I don't want another gun near my family. The first one was bad enough, but that one looks far more dangerous," Jim hissed. Savannah bent over, pretending to pick something up, but looking towards them. She gasped then, giving away her presence. Jim spun around to face her, even as Bill tried to hide the handgun he was holding, but it was too late. Malachi had been only a few feet away, and he'd seen the gun as well.
"Dad?"
he asked, his voice revealing his shock. Jim sighed, his shoulders slumping forward. "It isn't what it looks like," he tried to explain.
"It looks very much like another gun," Tanya said, irritation in her voice.
"I'm sorry," Bill apologized. "This is my gun. I brought it from home. Things are bad out there."
Tanya was shaking her head. "Jim, you said no guns, and now we have enough to form an army," she exaggerated.
Savannah had to fight to keep from rolling her eyes. An army? And who even knew if that first gun would even work? But this gun looked a lot like the one her father had. She didn't know specifics, but she knew it was going to be more reliable than the antique they'd been carrying.
"I know, but Bill has a point," Jim reasoned, surprising Savannah.
Everyone stopped talking and doing whatever it was they'd been doing, most of them staring at the gun as if it was a venomous snake.
Personally, Savannah was happy to have a real gun in the group. It made her feel safer. Or, well, it should have made her feel safer, but she doubted any of them knew how to use the thing. That was a little scary. She did, though. She was more than confident she could handle the gun if they'd give her a chance.
"What point?" Tanya asked.
"We don't have to shoot anyone, but if we can at least look like we can defend ourselves, it might be enough," Jim reasoned. Savannah fought the urge to do a facepalm. She couldn't let that comment go.
"My dad and uncle always said that if you have a gun, you have to be prepared to use it, or it will be used on you," she interjected, earning a number of horrified looks from the others.
"Do you know how to use a gun?" Tanya asked, clearly aghast.
"I do."
Bill grinned.
"Have you shot a 9mm before?"
She looked at the gun more closely, stepping forward.
"I think so. I don't know what it was my uncle had, but I shot a small gun and a rifle. I think it was a .22 or something like that. My uncle taught me how to load a magazine and gun safety in general," she answered nonchalantly. "And that looks like my dad's gun, which I shot once."
"Show me how to shoot," Malachi blurted out. She raised an eyebrow. Now he was talking to her. If that was what it took.
"I can do that."
"I think I'd prefer you to leave the gun alone," Tanya said, her lips pursed.
"Mom, I'll be the one who learns how. I won't ask Dad to shoot someone. I will protect the family," he said proudly.
Bill cleared his throat.
"It's my gun. I'll carry it with me."
"Do you have extra ammo?" Savannah asked. Bill looked at her more directly, and she could feel him sizing her up.
"I have some."
She smiled, hoping he'd see the logic in letting her try it.
"Wouldn't it be better to have a backup plan in case something happens to you? We can show Malachi the basics.
With the revolver and your gun, we need to be sure more than two of us can shoot."
"I can shoot," Ken chimed in. "It's just been a while."
"So, three of us know. I think it would be smart if Malachi knew as well," she said, wanting the chance to prove her value to the group, and also get some time alone with Malachi.
Bill nodded. "I guess we can do that. Tomorrow I'll show him how to load and fire the gun."
Savannah didn't take offense to being excluded, nodding instead of arguing. She was getting used to it. Whether it had more to do with her being a girl or being a teenager, she wasn't sure. But this would give her something to talk to Malachi about, since he was clearly interested. And soon they'd get to her Uncle Ennis's house. He was the one who had let her shoot at his private gun range, and he'd respect her more than this group did. They all seemed to think she was a helpless little girl, and she couldn't wait to get away from them. They could leave her with her uncle and go on by themselves. She trusted her dad and uncle to keep her safe a million times more than she trusted these people. She was simply stuck with them for now, and knew that their group was better than none.
14. Austin felt every mile they had traveled over the last 2 days. It seemed ridiculous that 40 miles felt like 2,000, but riding bareback on a horse wasn't easy. The broken leg had just made it all the worse. Now he focused on Savannah, which was the only thing still keeping him going. Getting to her helped him get through the pain. She'd been alone for coming up on a month now, around 3 full weeks, and that was far too long. He'd suffered a serious setback and become extremely ill after trying to get on the horse the first day he tried. Amanda had been worried enough to make him seriously concerned he wasn't going to make it. After 3 days of high fevers, he'd felt like he was on the mend. but it had taken that long. Since then, there'd been a lot of healing, and a lot of arguing. He'd wanted to set off on horseback at the very moment the fever had broken, but Amanda's reasoning and his own pain had won the day. And a lot had changed in the interim. More people had shown up to try to pilfer Amanda's supplies, and she'd had to shoot her rifle in the air more than once to scare them off. As it was, two of her horses had been stolen. Or maybe the mean one had run off when she'd stopped feeding him carrots and oats, if her suspicions were correct. With the barn gone, there'd been too few supplies, and no good method of protecting them while she and Austin slept. And they'd agreed it might be a matter of time before her remaining horses, Raven and Charlie, disappeared. Even now, he wasn't sure how it had happened, but one of them had raised the idea of her accompanying him to find Savannah, taking what supplies she had along with her horses. There was nothing keeping her on the farm, and she wanted news of what had happened. He liked to think that they'd grown into enjoying a friendship also. At least he hoped that she wasn't tagging along simply because she felt responsible as some sort of caretaker. One way or another, the moment he'd felt like he was strong enough, he'd insisted they leave the farmhouse and go in search of Savannah. It had been a huge battle to get Amanda to agree, as she'd wanted to wait another week. But finally she'd caved in. And it turned out she'd been ready to go, to the point that he guessed she worried she was more of a target in the farmhouse than she'd been letting on, between being a single female and a veterinarian. She traded with Daniel, offering some medicine and food in return for a cart and harness that she'd hooked up to her Charlie and loaded up with supplies practically before he'd blinked. Now, though, after 3 days of on-and-off travel to make the 40 miles to his and Savannah's RV, he wondered if they should have taken their chances and waited another week. "It's just around the corner," he grunted, the throbbing of his leg beating in time to his heartbeat. "You look awful," she muttered from her horse beside him. She shrugged, gripping Raven's mane and harness in a way that probably gave away just how much agony he was feeling. "But I'm alive." "Barely." The rhythmic plodding of the horse's hooves remained oddly cathartic as they traveled down the dirt road he knew would lead him to the back side of the farm they'd been staying on. They'd encountered gangs the first day they had left Amanda's place, but not seen much of anyone since then. Fortunately, Amanda had brought along several of her guns, giving him a Glock to hold on to. Thankfully, the gang had been on foot and only armed with baseball bats. "We're not far," Austin told her, feeling better about their progress now that he was somewhat familiar with where they were. His eyes scanned the horizon, looking for any signs that there had been trouble on the farm. "Up here," he said excitedly, pointing to where his fifth wheel was parked in the field next to the long driveway. He got the horse to move a little faster then, anxious to find Savannah. He imagined she was inside writing or reading a book, just waiting for him. "Let's get to the stairs of your RV. I'll help you dismount," Amanda called out, riding ahead of him. He ordered Raven to stop and slid from her side, putting his weight on his good leg. Amanda dismounted Charlie nearby and grabbed the cane she had found in the back of her father's closet, giving it to Austin to use. It had been about 3 long weeks since he'd broken the leg. It was healing, but bearing his full weight still wasn't possible. The crutches had been too awkward to try and carry on the horse, too, and they decided they weren't worth their space in the cart, since Austin could use the cane well enough for short distances now. He hobbled up to the front door, trying to hop more than walk. "Savannah!" he called out. There was no answer. He tried the door and was surprised to find it unlocked. He yanked it open, already sensing she wasn't there. The place even felt still, and he turned around without taking a step inside.
"Savannah!" he called out again, swinging around to look over the farm's land. Where was she? Even if she'd gone to the house to stay with Bob, wouldn't she have been keeping an eye out for him? But the whole place looked abandoned. He didn't hear or see anyone, not even the farmer's horses. He froze in the doorway of the trailer, stunned. It had never occurred to him that she wouldn't be there. "Let me check inside," Amanda said in a soft voice. Amanda returned a couple seconds later, handing him a note. He snatched it out of her hand and read it, his heart dropping. "Oh, no," he groaned. "Who's Ennis?" Amanda asked. "My brother. His house has to be at least 1,200 miles from here. They're walking?" he said, shock and fear making his voice shrill. Amanda looked again at the note, patting Charlie's neck absently. "Your daughter left 4 notes like that, just that I saw, all saying the same thing. She wanted to make sure you'd know where she was headed. She's got a solid head on her shoulders, obviously. And at least we know she's safe, and not alone." There was a lump in his throat. What Amanda said was true. But why had Savannah left? "I'm going to talk to Bob. He owns this place, so maybe he can tell me what happened. Why would she leave?" he asked, more to himself than Amanda. She shook her head, her eyes darting around the open property. "Let's go over to the house. I'll get the horses taken care of while you talk to your friend." Amanda stepped in beside him without another word. He knew the drill. He wrapped his arm around her petite shoulder and let her support his weight while they slowly trudged across the driveway, the horses plodding along behind them. It was such a short distance, there was no question that limping along beside Amanda was easier than getting back onto Raven for the duration. As they got closer, his eyes landed on a cross made from a couple of branches stuck in a rectangular pile of dirt near the barn. "What is that?" Amanda asked. Yet they both knew exactly what it was. "A grave." Austin ground out the words, stating the obvious. "Who?" she asked. "It wasn't there before," he said, feeling dread wash over him. They kept moving towards the house. Amanda reached out first and knocked on the door. When no one answered, she pushed the door open, going in first. "Bob?" he called out from behind her, hoping the farmer was napping or hiding out. The house even felt empty, just like the farm itself. "Sit down in one of those chairs. I'll check and see if anyone's home," Amanda ordered him. Austin knew he should protest. It should be him checking the house. Nevertheless, he flopped down on the worn recliner, the throbbing in his leg subsiding a little with the change in position. He could hear Amanda moving through the house, knocking on doors and calling out. Austin's eyes roamed the living room. It was neat and tidy, with no signs of trouble. That had to be a good sign. "No one's here," Amanda announced. "We need to know who's buried out there," he whispered. "It isn't Savannah. She left you that note," Amanda reminded him. He rubbed a hand over his face. "You're right. Maybe it's Bob," he reasoned. "Why would she leave?" "Because he died. You think? Why wouldn't she wait for me, though?" he asked, frustrated to have made it so far, only to discover she was gone. "She said it was too dangerous to stick around here. She was smart enough not to stay in danger." "I don't know those people she's with. She had a crush on the kid that was with them. Have you ever heard of them?" he asked her. "Kind of. I don't think they're bad or dangerous. They're a little weird, and they may try and convert her, but I don't think they'll hurt her, if it's the family I'm thinking of.
They've been traveling through this area for years doing their revivals.
Austin shook his head. His stomach was in knots.
I'll kill them if they hurt her. One of the recult and they won't let her leave.
Her note said she was going to your brother's house, Amanda pointed out. Not joining a cult.
What if they said that to get her to go with them and have no intention of letting her go? He shot back.
Amanda took a deep breath and looked back at him. Think about what you're saying, Austin. There's no point worrying more about it right now. It is what it is. I'm going to get the horses settled in that barn out there, then look around and see if I can find some food.
And then we have to get going, he muttered.
She looked at him, and then his leg, before turning and walking away. The 40 miles getting to the farm had nearly done him in, and they both knew it. He felt as weak as a kitten. There was no way he could get on that horse and ride 1,200 miles. The Loveridges had almost a 3-week head start, too, what with all the delays Austin had encountered. He stared down at his leg, wrapped in the purple casting material Amanda had used to freshen the cast before they'd left her place. She had a real thing for the girly colors. It seemed as if he couldn't catch a break, no pun intended. Everything was all wrong, and he had no idea if or when he would ever be able to make it right again.
Look.
Amanda came back into the living room, holding up a blue shoe-looking thing.
What's that?
He asked. A walking boot. It might be a little small, but I can rig it to fit you. This will help tremendously. I still don't want you going for a hike, but this will help you get around and support your leg.
Austin forced a smile, seeing she'd been thinking of him even before the comfort of her horses.
That said a lot.
Thank God. You know, Bob had a lot of horses. There may be some saddles out in the barn, he said hopefully. There's a pond behind the house also, now that I think of it. You can get the horses watered there before you put them up.
Thanks, I was worried about that. I'll check for saddles too.
With that, she seemed to hesitate, looking around the room.
Austin, I know you don't want to, but I want you to lie on the couch and elevate that leg for at least 20 minutes.
I'll put the boot on after that, she said, dropping down in front of him and pulling off his own boot, then removing his sock without asking.
He was used to her tending him now. The awkwardness was gone, though it still made him uncomfortable when he allowed himself to think about it. At this point, she knew his body about as well as he did after 3 weeks of taking care of him. Now he watched as she checked his toes and made a clucking sound.
What? He growled.
Your foot is swollen again. Come on, to the couch, she ordered, helping him out of the chair. He hopped over to the couch and collapsed into its cushions, letting her use the throw pillows to elevate his foot.
Thank you, he muttered. Maybe you could grab me some fresh clothes from the RV, too? He asked.
Absolutely. I'll be back, she said, before she walked out the front door, leaving him alone in the house. It was eerily quiet. He'd been in Bob's house several times. The old guy always had a radio on, listening to a game or the news. He wondered what had happened to him, and if Savannah had been around when it happened. Maybe that's what had scared her off from staying. There were so many questions he wanted to ask her. He closed his eyes, hoping she was already with his brother. Ennis would be prepared for something like this. If Savannah could get there, she would be safe. Of that much, he was sure. The problem was, he didn't trust the people she had left with. He'd only met the Loveridge family one time, and he'd felt an immediate dislike for them. They were weird. It was that simple. Jim had been way too happy for his liking. The guy reminded Austin of one of those TV pastors
begging for money for a new private jet while making promises of salvation to unsuspecting people. He hoped Savannah was smart enough not to fall for their charms. He would move heaven and earth to get her away from them. His hand slid into his front pocket, clasping the USB he still carried. If all the computers in the country were truly fried, it seemed silly to hold on to the USB. But something told him not to let go of it. Not yet. "You were right," Amanda said, coming back into the house. "About?" "There were a couple saddles. I'll get them taken care of, and then come in to see about scrounging us up something to eat. Oh, I'll grab clothes from your RV, too. Anything else?" He shrugged, unable to focus on what he might want from the RV. What he wanted was his daughter, here by his side, safe. "We need to get moving," he said without conviction. "There is no way you're riding anywhere today. You have to let that leg rest." "I'll be fine," he said through gritted teeth, tired of the same old argument. "Austin, you won't be fine. You're barely able to stay on Raven as it is. You just recovered from a serious infection. You're weak, and you need the rest. I got you here. Trust me. We'll leave in a day or two." "I want you to rest," she ordered him. He glared at her, wanting to argue, but experience told him it was pointless. She'd hide the horses from him if she had to. She'd taken the crutches away back at her place just to keep him still. The woman was fierce. He knew he should appreciate it, but it was difficult to put up with. "Fine, I'll sit here like a giant lump and wait," he grunted, "for a day. Two at most, Amanda, that's it." She grinned. "Good. I'll be back inside in a bit to see what food we have left to eat." "Whatever," he sulked. As she walked away, he wondered whether or not she'd be willing to accompany him to Colorado, or let him take her horse. He wasn't quite sure what would happen if she didn't, and could only hope that her wanting to get off of her own farm and accompany him this far signaled promise for what he faced now. 15. Ennis Merriman stood in the center of his living room, staring at the window. He couldn't see through the window because of the steel door that had been engaged when something catastrophic had happened. What, he wasn't sure. Or maybe nothing had happened. Maybe his multi-million-dollar home had just malfunctioned, and now he was trapped inside a steel box with no way out. Steel doors had dropped down, sealing him inside the home he had built to withstand a nuclear war. Some malfunction had happened, for sure, catastrophe or not, because he couldn't even disengage the supposedly man-operated escape hatch. "I swear, I'm going to sue the guy who installed this system," he muttered. It had been weeks since the walls had literally come crashing down around him. He'd been watching TV and enjoying a cold beer when there'd been what he assumed was a power surge. The TV and lights had gone out immediately, even though he was connected to solar power, which made no sense to him. And he couldn't call anyone to get an answer either. His phone wasn't working. He couldn't say for sure what had happened, but something had shorted out the computer in the house that was supposed to have been completely protected from surges, EMPs, and everything else. It was supposed to be impenetrable. Unfortunately, the only conclusion he could come to was that he'd made a mistake in the contractors he'd hired. He'd been warned not to go with the cheapest options, and he hadn't done it on all things, but apparently he'd gone with enough cheap and under-the-table options to kick him in the backside. The house had been so expensive, though, he'd had to cut a few corners, or at least that was what he told himself at the time, promising himself he'd get everything double-checked at a later date, once the initial gadget payments were all made. This house had been his brainchild, after all. He'd used his wealth gained from working as a real estate agent to build the house from scratch. It had taken over a year to create his mountain retreat, and it was supposed to be the safest place on the planet. It was supposed to be better than the bunkers built underground by the wealthiest of the wealthy. And yet here he was, trapped inside of his dream home. When he'd bought the land nestled on the east side of the Rocky Mountains, he'd had it all in hand, everything he'd ever dreamed of. Access to the big city, while living off the grid in his own secluded part of the mountains. He walked to the touchpad again, entering his private code and hoping something would happen. The screen lit up. "Hello," the female voice echoed through the speakers built into the ceiling high above. "Open the front door," Ennis said, slow and clear, and for what had to be the 100th time since he'd been trapped inside the house. "I'm sorry, that function is not available." He groaned, fighting the urge to slam his fist into the wall pad. "Open the door," he said slowly, telling himself not to start yelling at the damn computer again. All that accomplished was a sore throat. "I'm sorry, that function is not available." "Ah!" he shouted, yelling at the ceiling. "I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. Can you please repeat your request?" the droning voice asked. Ennis took a deep breath before shutting down the system again. "I swear, if I die in this house because I got a bad system, I will never forgive that punk kid. You're supposed to be Alexa and Siri on steroids," he shouted at the wall pad. The system was on power save, according to the little battery on the screen, conserving energy because it was relying on battery life. But that wasn't supposed to happen because he had solar power, so it shouldn't be necessary. Solar. What the heck had happened to throw even that off? Already he regretted not hooking up the wind turbine he'd installed last year. At the time, it had seemed like a good idea to have a backup, but it had seemed like it could wait, and everything he'd read told him solar was the way to go. So there the turbine sat, high on the hill behind his house, currently useless. Giving up, he walked into the huge gourmet kitchen and pulled a glass out of the cupboard, running the tap to get some water. At least that part of the house was still functional. He had a few thousand gallons of water stored in a tank high up on the hill behind the house. The gravity-fed system was enough to give him decent water pressure. There was a pump hooked up that should have worked, but it had stopped when the walls had come down. "So much for the perfect house," he grumbled. The power had failed. It was that simple. And essentially, the house itself had failed in response. The wall pad was run off a small battery system that seemed to be functional, as far as he could tell, but it wasn't running the house systems like he'd intended. Somewhere, something had shorted. His batteries connected to the solar panels weren't holding any juice, that much he knew for sure. He wasn't an electrician or a techie by any means, and had no idea why they weren't working. He'd bought the setup from some guy who'd claimed it was used in some of the super-secret government safe rooms. Ennis was now convinced that that had been a load of crap. It had worked great when he'd tested it, but the second the main power had been cut, the system failed. The one single window that wasn't now covered by a steel door was high up on the wall in the kitchen and dining area, and it now offered